So you have heard this week about our teachings on the four foundations of mindfulness, and we have been teaching and speaking about the first foundation, mindfulness of the body, and working a lot with the body. And then we also were practicing with the second foundation, mindfulness of Vedana, which is called feeling tone, which is not feelings as we understand them in English, but this sense of every moment having a pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant valence, and so that we can notice the second foundation as it arises. And then the third foundation, which we were learning last night with Bob's talk, and then this morning with the meditation, is this mind states, mindfulness of mind states. And so the emotions, the thoughts, and this interplay between the emotions and the body, and how all of that this happens. And so tonight, I'm going to be speaking tonight, this afternoon, I'm going to be speaking about something that is in the fourth foundation, which is mindfulness of dhammas, of dharmas. And so we'll be talking about the seven factors of awakening, the seven awakening factors, or the seven factors of enlightenment. And the fourth foundation is this way that we kind of, you can see we're going through, and we're kind of now we're being mindful of the ways the world operates. And so tonight we'll be talking about these ways that we can see these signposts of enlightenment or awakening. And I wanted to start with this refrain in the Satipatthana Sutta. The Satipatthana Sutta is the four foundations of mindfulness sutta. And after each one of these foundations, there's a refrain that's echoed throughout. And it says, in this way, and this is for the first foundation, in this way, in regards to the body, one abides contemplating the body internally, or one abides contemplating the body externally, or one abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. So this kind of it's a little like what? So this is language for one abides contemplating internally. How is it resonating internally? But also remembering that we are in a context. So one abides contemplating the body externally. Here we are with all of this happening externally. And then at the same time, both internally and externally. So these are the instructions that are offered again and again in the Satipatthana Sutta. So I want to put this as the context for our understanding of the seven factors of awakening. Sorry, I have to pause because my hearing aid battery just went out, so it's making noises. Don't let me forget that. All right. So I'm going to take us on a little journey first because we're all on this journey towards awakening. So I want to start the journey in my 20s, and for 7 summers, as it turned out, although they weren't all awake summers in my 20s, as you can imagine, I worked in the mountains in New Hampshire for the Appalachian Mountain Club. And so there's a series of backcountry cabins in the mountains in New Hampshire there. And I was part of a crew that would pack in food and everything that was needed. And so I was working at this cabin, this lodge, really, at the top of one of the mountains, and people would come and they would spend the night, and we would cook food for them. And if there was a rescue, a search and rescue, we would do that. If the lights went out, we would take care of that. If the septic, everything. It was amazing responsibility. It was wonderful to be entrusted with all of this in my 20s to just really care for people in the backcountry. And so, as Bob was mentioning the other day, in New England, if you are interested in the weather, wait a moment. And so the weather in this area in New England is some of the worst in the world, and even at the top of the mountain there's a weather station, and the recorded winds are the highest in the world. And that's because of the weather station, not because they are actually the highest, but 231 miles per hour. And so one morning, it was my job to go out and meet the truck that was going to be with the supply. So I had to hike up to the top of the mountain to meet the truck to bring the supplies down. And other people were going to follow later, but I was going to be the first one. So I woke up early and I put on my backpack. And on top of the backpack was all the trash that I was carrying out. So it was these pack boards. And so it was was quite high with all this trash, not very heavy, but really high. So I went out of the building up, it was above tree line, all rocks, and I just walked out the door and boom, knocked over by the wind, just like that, stood out the wind, and it was just like, I was on the ground. I thought, okay. And I went back in and I thought, well, what am I going to do? And then, so I took off the big backpack and then I put on my little backpack. And I proceeded to go up this trail, which I'd been going on all summer. So I was quite familiar with it. And it was, to this day, one of the most remarkable experiences in my life, because it was as if I were a leaf. I was walking and just sort of, going to take a step, and the wind would come and I could see the trail below me, and we were all in the fog. And it was just amazing, because it was just this, like an experience of my body being so other than I had ever experienced it, because my body was a leaf in this wind that was, and I was, all I could do was sort of just stay on the trail as I made my way up the mountain in the fog and seeing the rocks below me and seeing the markers of the trail and trying to find my way. And it was an experience of no separation. There was absolutely no separation. I had to be so present with these conditions, with the wind and the fog and maintaining my body on the trail. And I had this destination that I needed to get to. There was absolutely no separation between me and the mountain and the weather. And it was all came together. And so it really wasn't like I was going somewhere. It was just being carried along. And so then when I arrived at the summit, to meet the supply truck and got out of the wind, all of a sudden it was like as if I came back into a body, and my body was cold. Like, oh my gosh, someone gave me a cup of hot chocolate. I went inside, but it was really amazing because I could feel the residue of this experience in my body of non-separation that was just indescribable. There was a way that this somatic experience stayed with me, even though I wasn't in it anymore. And so I offered this story not because all of you are going to go hike mountains or if that's your thing, but because we all have had journeys to this point. We all have had journeys, and we all have had different teachers and teachings before we began practicing Buddhism. And so this experience happened to me before I was practicing, before I had any understanding of interbeing or interconnectedness or anatta, the Pali term for no self. And nature has and continues to be such an important teacher for me. And so this was, this was my first Dharma teacher, was being up in the mountains, particularly that time in my 20s, where I just really got a new understanding of what it meant to be alive. And there I was literally on a path. I was on a trail. I was on the path, and I was looking for these signposts, to kind of keep me in this whirling world. And what I want to talk about tonight are these seven factors, the seven awakening factors, as signposts, as ways that we can be like, oh, there they are. Not as something to strive for or attain, but just to be like, oh, okay, I'm going to notice and take note. And so these are the Buddha's teachings, especially in this fourth foundation, is like, what is skillful to pay attention to? So these are things that are skillful to pay attention to. And so I'm going to give you the list, because this is one of the Buddhist lists, and then I'll go into each one of them. Some of them are the frequent flyers, so you'll have heard of them before, and others may be like ones you're not as familiar with. So the first one is mindfulness, and being aware. We've talked a lot about mindfulness. And then the next six are in two parts. So there's two parts, the arousing factors, the energizing factors, which we have curiosity, or sometimes called inquiry or discernment. And then we have energy, or sometimes that's called effort, joy, rapture. So these are the energizing ones of curiosity, energy, and joy. And then there's the calming factors. And the calming factors are tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. So we have these signposts that we can be looking for, the arousing factors and the more tranquilizing or tranquility factors. And so all of these unfold naturally. So they're not about getting anywhere. It's just about paying attention to when they arise. And so it's a helpful way for us to orient ourselves. And so the Buddha talks about how in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha says, I do not say that final knowledge is achieved all at once. On the contrary, this knowledge is achieved by gradual training, by gradual practice, by gradual progress. And so this is this way that we are just committing ourselves to showing up, And in moments we will have, woof, little insights or sparks or something, but it's just this gradual process. And even more so, in another sutta, the Buddha says, the ocean gradually slants and slopes and inclines. In the same way, this teaching and training, the penetration to enlightenment comes from gradual training, gradual progress, not abruptly. This is one of the first things about this teaching and training. So this is helpful for me to think about this being a gradual path. Particularly in our society where there is such a linear orientation towards progress. There's a sense of, we are climbing the ladder to success, and then we will obtain some sort of pinnacle and we'll have made it and that's it. And interestingly enough, in other countries, success is not marked as a pinnacle. Success is sometimes seen as being at the center. So it's really interesting for us to kind of mark how we think about where we are. So in this gradual progress, sometimes it may feel like we're not going anywhere. So because we might get used to being like, okay, we're going up. And we all know, like corporations or whatever, they want their charts, always going up. And then we see them in the paper, all of a sudden, it goes down. And that's just like our life, just like our gardens, just like everything, up and down. There's ups and downs. And so it's gradual. So we have to have this confidence in the path. Christina Feldman talks about the seven factors of awakening and is referring to one of the images that the Buddha uses about the waters. Christina Feldman's a Buddhist teacher in England, and she talks about how the waters in the Himalayas come down and they gather in pools and then they flow into streams and rivers and gradually towards the ocean. So you can see it's not just a direct path, boom, it's gradual pools and streams over rocks. And so that's kind of what our path is like. And then she says, in the same way as we engage in these qualities, the mind starts to dissolve the afflictive patterns behind it and inclines us towards freedom and understanding. Indeed, the awakening factors are sometimes referred to as the anti-hindrances. There's a way in which these qualities actually provide antidotes to and a pathway out of the more afflictive qualities of the mind. So this is a way that we can pay attention to the awakening factors because they are actually antidotes to some of the things that we were talking about, sense desire, the craving, the aversion, sleepiness, doubt. So being able to recognize the awakening factors can help support us to be like, when there's other things to focus on, they can actually begin to allow us to let go of or pay attention to something other than the hindrances. And so the first of these factors is mindfulness. So we've talked a lot about mindfulness, and there's this phrase that just repeats in my mind over and over, with mindfulness to the fore, with mindfulness to the fore. So just to me, that's just things like, well, if I don't know what to do, mindfulness to the fore. you know, at the front. And it's like a Victorian language. So I don't know, it sort of comes up because it's sort of this way that I would never say it myself, but it helps resonate in my mind in that way. Like, okay, where is my mindfulness? Gathering my mindfulness. And so the word in Pali is sati, S-A-T-I. And that's this way to bear something in mind, to bear something in mind. And so as we bear something in mind, we're holding it just lightly. And I think this is important because sometimes we think that the mindfulness needs to reach out and grab an object and bring it back. Reach out, grab an object and bring it back. And mindfulness is this quality of awareness that's really receptive. And when I started practicing, I had this understanding of mindfulness as if I had a background in science, and I had this understanding of mindfulness as if I was a scientist. I do think this is a very useful one. So it's not that I'm letting go of it, but I had like, I'm a scientist, and I was like, I was the object of my awareness. And I was like, you know, put on my lab coat, my mindfulness with my lab coat on. And I was going to have this purely objective awareness and try to get rid of, you know, like let go of all of those other things. And that is a wonderful attribute of mindfulness, to just clearly know. And at the same time, we have a subjective understanding of the world. And so if we try to just get rid of our subjective understanding, sometimes our ignorance thinks that we have gotten rid of something and it's still kind of creeping around the edges. And so I've come to think of this as sort of mindfulness as being kind of what I mentioned this to someone in one of our meetings today, of like moist mindfulness, of like a mindfulness that is meeting like an old friend, like, oh, hi, you know, this is like a welcoming rather than just like, let me clear off the lab table and, you know, do that. And sometimes it's both of them, but this, to me, it has been a way that's really helped me not get to this sense of I am not connected to my external circumstances. And so this idea of moist mindfulness helps me join the internal and the external, to know that I'm connected internally and externally. So as we practice with mindfulness, we begin to see the conditions and the patterns of our lives, and then we can meet them with this gentleness. When we can meet with them with this encouraging, we can meet them over and over again, and then we begin to see the Vedana, we begin to see the mind states and how they all kind of work together. And, you know, sometimes it's the body and then there's a mind state, sometimes there's a mind state and then the body. And so there's this whole way that mindfulness can orient ourselves in our life. And so the second on this side of the arousing factors, the first one on the list is often then what we've talked a lot about is inquiry or curiosity. And so we talked a little bit earlier, Mary Grace mentioned the difference between this analytical inquiry and this sort of curiosity of like wonder, like wonder. So this is a sense of cultivating, you know, a wonder, like, huh? Maybe seeing into the impermanent nature, not a kind of figuring out like, I've had to do my taxes and I'm going to add up all the numbers and figure out what this thing's. That's like inquiry, but that's like, whoa, that's a different part of the brain. We're really cultivating an intuitive knowing here. Not to say that we don't sometimes need to use the other one, but just here in our retreat, we're not really going there. And so one of the things about curiosity and how do we look at, what are we going to be looking for, is to look at what are sometimes called the skillful states and the unskillful states, or the wholesome states and the unwholesome states. And so it's not, you don't have to know all the lists that the Buddha said, but just things that are skillful would be like kindness, generosity, patience, you know, those things. Unskillful would be greed, you know, aversion, like miserliness. So those are just some examples of noticing when they arise. And here the thing is that we're just noticing, which is a very different quality than judging. It's like, oh no, I just took too much, you know, fill in the blank. And that we can feel the judging, but we could be just like, wow, wow, look at that. This is what's arising. And in the noticing of that quality, we are actually being mindful of it. And so then we're having that discernment, which is another word that I like to use with along with this curiosity, which is discernment of the state that's going on. And the place that I think the Buddha was instructions are so amazing is that the invitation is to look at the arisen qualities when patience arises, for example, and then the unarisen qualities. So that means when I'm not patient, I can be noticing I'm not patient. And that in and of itself is skillful. The noticing that I'm not patient is a skillful quality because I'm noticing, oh, patience isn't arising. Whoa, this is what it feels like to not be patient in the body. Oh my gosh, I'm really waiting and I feel this agitation. I am not patient. And then another time we're noticing patience and then we can discern, oh, what is what patience feels like in the body? And then we can have that discernment and then we begin to have the somatic and the embodied understanding of these differences of the skillful and the unskillful qualities. Or, for example, skillful to notice impermanence. It's skillful to notice how things change. And on the other hand, we can notice when we have an identity that gets really sticky. Perhaps there's an identity in your, that's a thought pattern that just goes around and around. And we can notice, wow, I am back in that identity of being, you know, a doctor, a lawyer, a parent, a student, you know, whatever it is, that identity that's very common for you. And in noticing the identity, we actually have awareness of it. And so that's the discernment. And so that can be like, oh, that's a factor of awakening. I am no longer caught. So it's like a magic trick to me because like the Buddha said, wow, we don't actually have to change the experience. We're changing our relationship to how the experience, how it's happening. So I have something arise. And then if I can see it, then it is, I'm no longer caught in it. So this is this quality of curiosity, inquiry, discernment, noticing what is happening, you know, really being there with it in this really receptive, curious way, giving careful attention. And so it really, sometimes people take it and it can be the judging. So if the judging arises, just be like, okay, you're a little curious there too. Like, what's that about? Because then we can bring the kindness. And then if we bring kindness to the judge, then we're bringing that skillful quality in again. So you can see this can get to be a little busy mind. So please work with it carefully. But this is, as I said, one of the signposts that when we just note these skillful qualities, it can be helpful because then we can be like when they arise the next time, we'll be like, right, there it is again. That's the signpost. So curiosity, you can see, is an energizing factor. So you can see that the mind would become a little alert. And so we can see the mind could get very energized around that. And so the next factor is energy. In Pali, it's virya, V-I-R-I-Y-A. And sometimes it's called effort. And so I really like to use the term energy rather than effort, especially in the dominant society where effort means efforting, like doing a lot. I mean, it's not like not what kind of effort is needed, but it's just this effort in one direction. And so perseverance, as we all know, is necessary. I mean, we wouldn't be here still if we didn't have perseverance. So all of us have this quality of diligence and effort and energy that has kept us showing up all week. And so when we practice, we can bring in this curiosity, you know, as well to this area of effort and energy. And the inquiry here is what is the appropriate effort that's needed? Because as we know, it's like, you know, if you're hammering in a nail, at some point you don't keep hammering because then you're just hammering the wood. The nail's in the wood and you don't start, you have to stop at some point and pause. And so for ourselves during our retreat, you may have realized that sometimes, oh, right, I need to rest now. this is a time of rest. I'm really, and then sometimes it may be, the body may say, oh, time to rest. And you think, oh, I think maybe walking meditation, I actually need to arouse the energy. So this is this place where you can see how the factors actually begin to intermingle. And many of you might be familiar with the story in the suttas that the Buddha engages with, in the Guttara Nikaya, the Buddha engages with Sona. And Sona is a monk who had been a lute player before he became a monk. And so the Buddha saw that Sona was very discouraged. And Sona apparently was like determined and like walking back and forth and back and forth, such that Sona's feet became like bloodied. Like it was, I'm going to get enlightenment or bust kind of thing. So Sona was working really hard and discouraged and was going to leave being a monk. He was just like, I'm out of here. Probably didn't say it that way. But anyways, so the Buddha saw this, and the Buddha came to speak to Sona and said, using the image of the lute, the Buddha said, what do you think? You know, when the strings of your lute are too tight, you know, would the lute sound, what would the quality of sound be? And Sona was like, well, no, it wouldn't sound very good. And then, you know, and then if the strings were too loose, you know, how would the sound be? And so Sona was able to realize, oh, if I'm either too tight or too loose, then, you know, there needs to be this right effort, this place that's appropriate effort. And so the Buddha says, in the same way, Sona, over-aroused persistence leads to restlessness. Overly slack persistence leads to laziness. I'm not sure about that translation there, but thus you should determine the right pitch for your persistent, attune the pitch, and there you pick up from there. So just this sense of really knowing that at times we need to let go and at times we need to engage. And so I find this just such a wonderful teaching to remember, oh, is it more energy needed? Or is this a time that I actually need to let go? And just one other thing about energy, because I think it's such an important one, is one of the teachings that was so illustrative of this to me is that after the Buddha passed away, there was a council where all of the enlightened monastics were going to gather to talk, you know, kind of look at the Buddha's teachings. And Ananda, who is the Buddha's attendant, who supposedly had a photographic mind. And so when you have the thus have I heard, it's usually Ananda who's saying that. And so they really needed Ananda, but Ananda couldn't attend because he hadn't been reached enlightenment. So Ananda was trying really hard. I got to get ready. I got to make this meeting tomorrow, trying to burst through. And it said that it was only as Ananda was like decided, okay, I'm going to sleep. It was only then that the mind let go. And so I love that because, you know, it's this effort. So that's the indication that we may think that what is needed is, and then we actually might need the relaxation. So this is where there's this curiosity and energy can be aligned. And so as we have these arousing factors, these energizing factors of curiosity, and then we can bring in this place of joy. Because when things start to become aligned, we have joy or rapture. Rapture is often how it's translated. And this is the Pali, it's the piti, P-I-T-I. And this is a real uplifting energy. And it's a really wonderful quality to pay attention to, because sometimes when we're practicing and we become mindful, our mind can be drawn towards what's wrong. You know, sort of the negativity bias, like what's not right here? Like all of a sudden, pain, oh my goodness, pain here, oh my gosh, pain. You know, our mind can like Velcro to, you know, what's not right. And so with this sense of like, is there actually something here that feels we can begin to bring our attention towards things that are really beautiful, light, and we can find that sense of beauty around us, this arousing factor of joy. And I want to share this quote from, there's a Zen monk who is, I really appreciate her perspective on things. She practiced at the San Francisco Zen Center and is now in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Zenju Earthland Manual. And she says, "We treat our lives as though they are investments. Without even realizing it, we wonder how we can make the most of our time, what we can get out of a particular experience or relationship, tethering ourselves to an unconscious viewpoint that turns our lives into never-ending projects." And I wanted to bring this in here with the place around joy, because I think if we think of ourselves in this betterment project, we often forget the joy, because we're always thinking that there's going to be something better, that the joy is around the corner. Like the joy is like, oh, I know it's going to be there. I'm just going to keep going better. I'm going to, this project of making JD better, I can do it, you know. And so, Mary Grace, you were talking about the little thing I can. I read, my mom always read that story about the little engine that could. And so when we focus on ourselves as an investment, this sort of transactional thing, we sometimes miss the joy that's right here. And so, I wanted to share a little bit of a poem, and it's just so inspirational to me. There is a prayer from the Navajo Blessing Way ceremony. And we know in the United States that the Navajo, and as with most of the indigenous people in the U.S., have, you know, been decimated and desecrated, and the violence has happened. And so when I read this poem, I just think about the confidence and the sense of ability to have a relationship to the moment. So it's the Walking in Beauty. And I'll just read a little bit of it. "Today I will walk out. Today everything negative will leave me. I will be as I was before. I will have a cool breeze over my body. I will have a light body. I will be happy forever. Nothing will hinder me. I will walk with beauty before me. I will walk with beauty behind me. I will walk with beauty below me. I will walk with beauty above me. I walk with beauty around me. My words will be beautiful. In beauty, all day long may I walk." And I think of this as like an invocation to know that the negativity is there. And yet, even in that, that there is, I am surrounded by beauty, not in a way to bypass the struggles, but as a way to remember the negativity and then also the capacity to grow and to notice the joy. So with mindfulness, we can notice these rousing factors in the body and we can feel their energizing quality. And then we can also know that there will be some times that we have the calming factors. And so with the calming factors, we have tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And so sometimes you'll find just that these rousing factors, especially joy, can turn into sort of a more calm contentment or tranquility. And sometimes it's not, sometimes you'll just find tranquility will arise in and of itself. One of the things in my own practice that I realized that was just really like, boom, is that I realized sometimes when I was bored, I was actually content. But I wasn't familiar enough with contentment that I thought like having contentment and peace was actually boring. And then as I learned, like this, like agitated mind was what I was so familiar with that I wanted the agitation. And then I started realizing like, ooh, I thought this was boring, but there's actually aside the boredom or just a little bit over here, there's some peace and contentment. And so it became this like, the mind was like, oh, change the channel. change the channel. But then I was like, oh, that's agitation. Wow, this is a whole other way of being here. You know, this like the mind is not moving. Huh, it's not about changing the channel. It's about becoming familiar with this more tranquility, that contentment. And so that was really an amazing thing for me to learn, because I got to realize, like, oh, what does it feel like in the body, this non-agitation? And then when I feel the agitation, I can be like, oh, this is the agitation. So the arising or the non-arising of it. So then I began to pay more attention, bringing my mindfulness to this quality, to recognize, like, oh, tranquility. And tranquility can be a real nurturing place of rest, because we might just, it can be so subtle that we could just jump right over it. Oh, I like the joy. You know, I want some curiosity. And then we can kind of stay up here, and it can sometimes move into agitation. And so these more subtle factors, sort of tranquility, that we begin to see and feel like, oh, I can rest here. You know, the sense of serenity. And I think it's really important to, as we practice these, to remember the sense of the arising of them and the non-arising of them. So sometimes we notice that we are not tranquil. And that's really skillful. That's a signpost of the awakening factor, that it's absent. I can think of many examples in my life where I am not tranquil. I am not calm. And just the noting is like, oh, this is what not calm feels like in the body. All right. Okay. Got it. And so, you know, then we can also be those places like, calm. And so the thing is that if we catch a moment of calm, because it could be more subtle, to as much as possible try to linger there, like savor that moment, pause, like that sense of the pause, and like, oh, right, this is peace. And so we might get curious about it, but what if we were just to sort of linger in that experience? And then we can have like those seeds that we were talking about. This is the seed of calm. This is the seed of peace. This is the seed of serenity. Oh, right. Because when we have the somatic experience, when we can know it in our body, then we can remember in the not calm moments that the body has felt calm before. Like, oh yeah, there was that moment I had calm. I am capable of being calm, even if I'm not calm right now. Like, I have that embodied knowing, the body wisdom. And so just to know, because we know, like, this, you are going to sometimes have the gentle seas, it'll be nice and calm, and then sometimes the waves are going to get rough. So sometimes we'll be in the not calm. So on this side of the more tranquilizing or easeful factors, the next one is a term, samadhi, S-A-M-A-D-H-I, samadhi. And it's often translated as concentration. And concentration is a useful shorthand, but it also can lead us into striving, which it is not. And so let me just explain kind of how beneficial concentration is, and then I'll kind of blow it out a little bit more to make it so to understand how it can be too narrow. But I love this description of concentration, Sarah Doring, who is a meditation teacher at Insight in Massachusetts, Insight Meditation Society. And she says, this is how she describes concentration. And it's really a beautiful description. Just imagining, you know, imagining like then the sunlight comes through like a window. If parallel rays of light fall upon a piece of paper, You know, they won't do much more than warm the paper. But if the same amount of light is focused through a lens, the paper will burst into flames. In the same way, concentration focuses the energy of the mind and gives it power to cut through surface appearances. And so, like, as our mind gets steady and settled and gathered, it becomes concentrated, and that capacity to focus is not wandering off as much. But the place where, if this image of concentration of being this narrowing of mind that I have experienced personally, and this idea of wanting to be concentrated, of wanting that, can end up with this striving that can get really, really rigid and contracted. And then you're kind of like, I want to get to that concentrated place because I want this, like I'm trying to burn that paper and I'm like, oh, you know, not going. And so I've spent many a retreat trying to get concentrated and really having a super contracted body and feeling all the aches and pains, and you know, the joy and the tranquility is then not there. And so what I've come to understand with this sense of samadhi, using the term samadhi, has been really helpful, because samadhi is a gathering and a unification. So we're gathering the mind and unifying. So we're having that focus, but it's more like a unification. And so for me, I had this experience of an image once that was very supportive for me to help me with this, rather than being this narrow laser-like concentration. And I was remembering how sometimes you see images of people gathering something with a basket, like they have a basket and they're gathering rice or something and the water is going through and they're concentrating in the basket. So you're gathering and things are you're letting go and you're gathering more and you're letting it go. And so this sense of gathering, like in the sense of kind of bringing together, which was felt much more receptive than directing. And so it's allowing some of this things to let go of why we're gathering, and we're calming and abiding. And I was still rousing my energy enough, but it allowed me to have a different image that I had to reach something that was kind of conflated with this idea of success and climbing the ladder. And there was this moment or laser beam of concentration out there, where it was just this way of, can I keep gathering it all together. Ajahn Suchito, who's in the Thai forest tradition, says samadhi is an enjoyment experience. And so here we have, you can see how the tranquility and the joy and the concentration, the samadhi, are all part of it. So one of the ways that we can tell is if we're getting too narrow is if we're not feeling that bit of contentment and peace and joy. And he gives these instructions for how to practice samadhi. And he says, Ajahn Suchito says, where do you feel your energies come together? So just sort of paying attention, where do your energies come together? Let the breath pass through that time and time again. Then he says, you'll find yourself neither snagging on it nor moving away from it. You'll find yourself settling in. Then you'll begin to experience some kind of continuing tone, which is another metaphor, of course, but listen into that if it's something you experience more as listening. If it's tactile, feel it. If it's an emotional, resonate with it. If it's visual, open to it. This is the sign. This is the quality of that experience, which is beautiful. Notice the beauty. And so this sense of concentration bringing with us this accompanied embodied beauty, this gathering. So you're not snagging the thought, you're not jumping over to that thought or jumping off to that thought. You're just sort of aligning and resonating, the sense of resonance gathering. And I really like this because beauty is not something that we can hold on to. You know, beauty is flow. It's impermanent. It's just kind of going through. And this is part of the place of faith and devotion that we just keep aiming towards with this confidence, this faith of being on the path. We don't hold it and grab onto it. You know, we kind of have this way that we are honoring ourselves, we're honoring our commitment, we're looking for these signposts to help us, and then we have a confidence. There's a, you know, really have to have some trust. You know, trust in the Buddhist teachings, trust in our own way of being, trust that this is a gradual path. We might be in the muck today, you know, but we're kind of in the pool. So it's a gradual path. And so as we have this trust, the last of the factors, equanimity, which we spoke to earlier this week, which is found on many lists, as is some of these other ones, that it's one of the important Buddhist teachings, equanimity. And, you know, I had never heard of the word equanimity before I started practicing Buddhism. And, you know, I was 35 when I did. So that was, you know, which tells you a little bit about how chaotic my life was, that I never even knew the word equanimity exists. I thought it was like a typo or something. What does it mean to be equanimous? You know, I had heard of equipoise, but I never knew equanimity. And so equanimity is this quality of the heart that has the capacity to be impartial of all things that arise. And so based on our habits and our conditioning, when something arises, often we have a preconceived notion. So equanimity is that ability to be impartial, not being motivated by our preferences, not being motivated by our self-centered desires and wants, not rejecting something, not pushing it away. This is the definition from the Theravada monk scholar Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he says, equanimity is the evenness of mind, unshakable freedom of mind, a state of inner equipoise that cannot be upset by gain and loss, honor, dishonor, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. Upekkha, which is the Pali word for equanimity, upekkha is freedom from all points of self-reference. All points of self-reference. So once again, this is an interesting place because it's if there's a receptive quality there, that the preferences, the reactions will arise, but how do we hold ourselves within there? And I really want to share this other image of equanimity from Ruth King, who is a mindfulness and Buddhist teacher. And she says, equanimity can feel internally like a great mountain with the mind solid and stable, undisturbed by the changing seasons. So sometimes equanimity appears and we can feel, you know, grounded, balanced. And then she says, or it can be like the ocean with the mind vast, deep, immeasurable, undisturbed by whatever swims, floats, or is housed in its waters. So sometimes you're just like, poof. And sometimes equanimity is just the vastness of the ocean. And then she continues, equanimity can be like a strong fire, roaring, engulfing, transmuting, undisturbed by whatever is thrown into it. Or like immense space, open, allowing, receiving, undisturbed by the objects that arise and pass away. I really appreciate these four elements of equanimity that Ruth King brings in, because sometimes I think equanimity has been sent as like this non-reactivity. And that's one capacity of it. But if you think of it as just non-reactivity, then that gets transmitted sometimes into passivity. And that gets transmitted into being a doormat. You know, just let me, like, everybody can just walk all over me. That's a little, I mean, there was a story that Bob shared about the Buddha walking over, but that was very intentional. That wasn't just like, let it all go, or whatever you do is fine. I mean, that's sometimes going to be a good quality, but that's actually not equanimity. And so equanimity is a non-reactivity of mind. But these are some images to help you see that equanimity is not a place either, that equanimity arises in relationship to the circumstances as well. And here's an example from the Buddha. And the Buddha says to Rahula, who is also his son, who is a monk, and he says, "Rahula, develop meditation that is like the earth. For then agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions will not take charge of your mind. Just as when people throw what is not clean and unclean on the earth, feces, urine, saliva, pus, or blood, the earth is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted by it. In the same way, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions will not take charge of your mind when you develop meditation like the earth." So this is kind of a description of equanimity, that, you know, we get all sorts of stuff coming at us, pleasant, unpleasant, things we like, things we don't like, you know. Just imagine Rahula was probably like, "Woo, feces, you're," you know, if I'm working with kids, because Rahula became a monk when he was really young, but will not take charge of your mind. None of these, pleasant, unpleasant, agreeable, disagreeable, will take charge of your mind. That's the mindfulness. The mindfulness is aware all of this is going by and it will not take hold, and the mind doesn't go galloping off into the pleasant. The mind doesn't go galloping off to so-and-so is throwing what at me. You know, the mind sees that. There may be some response at some point, but the equanimity is that sense of the vastness, like the ocean or the space, or just that ability to, you know, purification of the volcano, like just that sense that's happening. And so notice, the noticing of the equanimity is such a powerful thing. This non-reactivity is really amazing, to be able to have that. This state of inner equipoise that is the freedom from all points of self-reference. Doing it to me, that gets added on there. So these are the seven factors that we can look to as signposts for awakening. And so as you are practicing, when we have mindfulness, the mindfulness just in itself is on this gradual path. It's part of this journey. We know with the mindfulness, the four, we're leading ourselves in this journey, in this way of awakening. And then with that, the factor, you know, of curiosity can arise. And then that sense of energy and joy. And then sometimes we'll feel more the tranquility, the serenity and peace and the samadhi and equanimity. And then the other way that we can use these factors is that we can be aware of, like, oh, I have a lot of the arousing factors. And then you can be like, well, inviting in some of the more peaceful qualities, or vice versa. So that either, as we become mindful of these different factors, we can be like, wow, I tend to go, my, you know, the preponderance of the peaceful ones. Maybe curiosity. What would it be like to practice with some inquiry or curiosity? Or if the mind's always like inquiring, you know, like bubbles, then we can invite in some of this more. Oh, is there any contentment available? Might there be some peace here? What would it be like to be equanimous now? And as we bring this in, when we consider that this is in the four foundation, where we are looking at this internally and externally, and then both internally and externally at the same time, and the place where we are in retreat, the factors of our external conditions have been really controlled. And so it's a really good place to look at the external conditions. And so that could even be throughout your day. So you may notice that even that the conditions at different points of the day that you have things that happen, you know, internally and externally. Because when the external factors get much more complex, you know, in other situations that we know of, that we all experience, then it's harder to pay attention because they're so complicated. But here we can pay attention to the internal and the external, and then we can know even what it's like if you are meditating in the hall by yourself or you're meditating in the hall with more people. There's a different quality internally and externally. So we can begin to see that this sense of non-separation, non-self-referential is really impactful. So practicing with both internal and external really helps us prevent, you know, this sense of self-centeredness that can get when we get really internal. It's all about me. I mean, it's all about me, but you know, you too sometimes, right? So the practice does end up here because that's where we're practicing. And it's construct. It's a construct. So it's a very, you know, it's a facility of mind that we say, I am meditating. It's a facility that we say we are meditating. You know, and it's really helpful in the understanding of ourselves to know ourselves so that we can know each other. Because in this place of equanimity, of non-self-referential mindfulness, then we don't even project, you're just like me. How do I know that? Well, the Buddha does say there's some human conditions, but your conditions haven't been just like mine. And the other day when Mary Grace was talking about this way that we measure ourselves better than, less than, the Buddha even said that it's a conceit to think that we are the same as. And for me, this has been quite freeing because each one of us is this amazing, unique manifestation of coming together of earth, water, fire, and air into this incarnation of who you are, a beautiful, necessary being on the planet that is needed. And so these qualities and these capacities of mind that we each have can be cultivated, and we can begin to know ourselves and know each other. And in this way, we can relate more from a sense of openness and non-reactivity rather than from a closed, self-centered focus. So I started off with the feeling of non-separation on my hike up the mountain, and I wanted to end with this poem by Izumi Shikibu, who was mentioned earlier this week, this Japanese poet, and she has amazing pithy sayings, and she says, although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. So in Buddhist imagery, the moon often symbolizes the coolness of enlightenment, the enlightened mind. And so here's this enlightened mind that's, you know, this beautiful moon. And then there's the wind, and then there's this ruined house. You know, you can think the rafters and the moon's kind of coming through the ruined house, kind of just all of the foibles of what it means to be us, you know. But the moonlight still shines. It is available. And when we pay attention to these factors of enlightenment, it can help us know that we have these signposts, that there's ways that we can be on the path and can just be a reminder to us, because it may not look like what we thought it was. And just kind of just being on the looking for them as we're out there, it can support us in shining the sense of clarity and awakening for us. So thank you for your kind attention. Let's just take a moment and let the words settle, and coming back to stillness. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house.